So as I said last week, this is going to be a two-part series. Just this week. Oh, sorry, there's any more sheets around? There we are. There's a two-part series this week and next week, and then we're going to break for everyone to get ready for Pesach and to experience Pesach. And I'll send out the dates of the new term. In a few weeks. Okay, so I wanted to focus on Pesach and the lessons we learned from Pesach, and the way I want to do it this time is the following. First of all, the preparation for any festival is really important. In Judaism, some of you might have watched my little video on that this week, but in Judaism we know there's an amazing emphasis on preparation, right? There's this concept that we need to prepare for everything. The reason for that is because when you prepare for something, then you have a relationship with that thing. In other words, if a festival just comes, we just observe it at some level and it comes and goes, then we never really connected with it, right? We just did it. So there's a difference between doing something and connecting to something. And in Judaism, the thinking is that the way you connect with something is to prepare for it. So you prepare, the more you think about it before, the more you talk about it, the more you learn about it, the more we connect to it, when it comes around, we're experiencing it at a deeper level. I think that's true with everything, but it's particularly true with Pesach. Pesach, we have a Seder. We experience the Seder. It's a beautiful Yontif. I know it's hard, but it's a beautiful Yontif anyways. But there's so much depth to it. It's interesting. I was just talking to someone before I came here. I met up with someone, and we were talking about this idea, and he says, yeah, does a Seder every year, first night, second night. I said, but how much do you know about the Seder? He says, not much. I said, well, that's it. I said, we should learn, right? We should try and understand what the depth is. So what I want to do for this series, this week and next week, I titled the series Three Steps to Personal Freedom, because I want to take something that's in the Haggadah that has the three ideas, which I'll get to in a moment. And in the context of that, the Seder that we do on Pesach is really supposed to be a personal experience, right? So the idea of Yitziat Mitzrayim, we've talked about this many times, going out of Egypt. First of all, as we always say in Judaism, we don't celebrate history, we re-experience history. So it's the idea of re-experiencing that energy, that connection, that idea every single year. So when we say we commemorate the Exodus from Egypt, that means we commemorate when historically the Exodus of Egypt actually happens. But really, spiritually speaking and emotionally speaking, psychologically speaking, the personal Exodus from Egypt happens every year, because we all have our own personal Egypt. As the Kabbalah teaches, we all have our own personal Mitzrayim. And what's interesting is that we know the Jews were in Egypt, called Mitzrayim in Hebrew. And the king of Mitzrayim, of course, was Paro, right? And what is that? So what is that exile, spiritually speaking? What is that prison, so to speak, right? So the word Mitzrayim, we've talked about this before, the word Mitzrayim comes from the word Meitzar, means constriction, limitations, border, like a prison, where something's very narrow. In fact, right, a lot of you would know the song, Kol Ha'alam Kula Gesher Tsar Me'od, right? So the word Tsar is the same word as Mitzrayim. In fact, it has the word tsar in it, right? Because tsar means narrow. It's very narrow. You can't move. You don't grow. So where does that come from? So we have this concept, which I think we discussed many years ago, but we have this concept in Judaism and in Hasidic philosophy particularly, that we have this idea of the narrowness of the throat. I don't know if you remember this, but the narrowness of the throat goes like this. We know that we are made up of different layers. So we have the layer of cognition, we think, right? We understand, we're able to make decisions based on our thinking. Then we feel emotion, which is in the heart, and then we behave. So basically the human consciousness is made up of these three parts, where we intellectualize things, we feel things emotionally, and then we behave accordingly, hopefully, right? The problem is as follows. The problem is that there's often cognitive dissonance. We might understand something, and yet not apply it or not even feel it at all, right? Why? Because the way it's supposed to work, especially spiritually speaking, the way it's supposed to work, and I say spiritually speaking because what I mean is, particularly when it comes to the godly soul, right? The animal soul, the animal impulsive person feel a lot of things. We have natural impulses, natural instincts, natural emotional reactions, which are animalistic and impulsive sometimes. But when we talk about the godly part of us, the way it's supposed to work is we're supposed to learn about things, understand them, whether it's understanding the importance of a healthy relationship, whether it's understanding the importance of not getting angry or not having resentment, whether it's the importance of putting up a mezuzah, or it's the importance of a mitzvah, or Pesach, whatever the case is. We learn about things, we understand them. What's then supposed to happen is we're supposed to develop a certain passion for those things that we understand, right? Because we know that intellect can give birth to emotion. That's what it says in Hasidic philosophy and in Kabbalah, that the Chochmah and Bina, which is the two parts of understanding, are like the mother and the father. When you think about something enough and you connect to it enough, you start to feel for it. You develop a connection to it. You develop a passion to it, right? And then when you get enthusiastic or passionate or emotional about something, then you're more keen and motivated and driven to then put it into action, right? That's the way it's supposed to work. The problem, however, is that we often get stuck. And this is the symbolism, the imagery of the narrow throat. What does that mean? Because we know that intellect is in the head. And the difference between intellect and emotion is very big, right? Because by definition, by description, they are two very different things. As we always say, the power of the mind is its greatest weakness. Why? When you think about something, if you go to a lecture and you think about something, right? Even if you think about the importance of something which is not your natural disposition, you have no problem intellectualizing it, right? You could, if you want to, you can make a commitment today to sit and to learn about the importance of something you don't do, something that doesn't speak to you, something that you don't, that is against your normal habit, your normal behavior. But it's no problem to listen to a lecture on it. Why? Because the power of the mind is to be objective, and the power of the mind is to bring in something and invite into your consciousness something that is not you. That's the power of the mind, right? That's why we know the mind is the human unique gift that we have to make a decision. To make a decision that might even be hard for us. So if you put it in a very sort of simple terms, if there's something that's unhealthy to eat and you really want to eat it, that's what you feel like doing, it won't be a problem if someone explains to you why it's unhealthy. And you listen. Does that mean you're not going to eat that piece of cake? Not necessarily. Why? Why? Right? Because you understand. You could probably even give the lecture yourself, right? So why doesn't it mean? Why? Because the way it works like this. In order to really decide you're not going to eat that cake, just I'm using a very simple analogy, okay? But that's what it extends to everything. But you have to feel passionate about it. You have to really be committed to it. You have to have a conviction that that's the right thing to do. Which means you have to have some level of emotion, some feeling for it, some commitment to it, some passion for it, right? Problem is that passion, emotion, conviction, all these things are completely different to intellect. Intellect is cold, objective. It's not you. There's a certain detachment. Transitioning to emotion means you've got to be passionate about it, right? That transition often doesn't happen. And the way Kabbalah puts it is that it starts off in the mind, and in the mind you fully understand it, you get the lecture, you can repeat it yourself, and then it's got to travel down to your heart and often get stuck on the way. Right, that's the imagery of the narrowness of the throat, because emotion is in the heart, intellect is in the brain, and in the way it gets stuck. Right, it gets stuck. And because it gets stuck, we might understand lots of things, but we don't grow, we don't progress, because we haven't brought it down, it hasn't penetrated the pathway, it hasn't gone down and transitioned to conviction or to commitment, to passion, and therefore it wasn't applied. That's the Kabbalistic cognitive dissonance formula, right? And that's Mitzrayim. That's what it means to be stuck in Mitzrayim. In fact, Kabbalah teaches us an amazing thing. Who is the king of Mitzrayim? Paro, right? By the way, it wasn't one individual. All kings of Mitzrayim were called Paro. It's the pharaohs of Egypt. That's the historic formula, right? The word Paro is a similar idea, funnily enough. The word Paro has the same letters as Oref. Oref means the back of the neck, right? Same part of the body. So often we are subjects of or slaves of our own Mitzrayim, our own Egypt, our own cognitive dissonance, where we can understand something, we know we shouldn't get angry at other people, we know we shouldn't have resentment, we know we should be more spiritual, we should be more godly, and yet we find it hard, right? And therefore, if you look in the Haggadah, it says, "B'chol dor v'ador," in every single generation, we need to see ourselves as if we are going out of Egypt. It's not talking about going out of an oppressive regime that's making us slaves. Thank God today we're not like that, for the most part. But it means the spiritual Egypt, right? And that's why we say in the Haggadah the famous words, right? V'hi she'amda. This is what I stood by us, the promise of God. I stood by us in all generations. Because in every generation, omdim aleinu l'chaloteinu, very familiar words, right? They stand up against us to try and destroy us. That could mean literally, like, what is happening? Yeah. Won't go far, thank God, but it is there, the will is there. But it doesn't only mean that. Because Jews have said this in great times. Jews have said this when they had golden ages of living very freely under other governments and so on and so forth. And they still said this paragraph. That all b'chol dor v'ador, in every generation, they stand and threaten our existence, because it doesn't only mean physically. It means spiritually also. It means our spiritual growth, our progress, our going out of our personal Egypt. That's what it means, right? And therefore, there's those forces that try to stop us doing that in every generation. But with the help of God, we can be saved and we can go out of Egypt. We can progress. We can go out of our comfort zone. We can experience growth. And there's no better time to do that than in the time of Pesach, which has the energy of growth. That's what Mitzrayim is. In fact, there's different types of growth, right? One of the ideas about Pesach is its name. Why is it called Pesach? Sorry? Passover, yeah. What does it mean, Passover? That God skipped over the houses, right? He jumped over the houses. But it's not just that he skipped over the houses. King Solomon, in the famous Song of Songs, he describes the imagery of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. And he talks about God coming to Egypt to save us. And he says, Medaleg al Harim, God was running, so to speak, jumping over the mountains, skipping over the hills. So there's this imagery of jumping when it comes to Pesach. Even today, we don't have the Paschal lamb, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, but we have this idea that the whole festival is called Pesach, right? Because God's this jumping idea. What's the idea of jumping? So we talk about growth, right? When people grow in their character, in their spirituality, in their godliness, whatever the case is. When they grow, they can grow two ways. Sometimes people grow, but they grow in a way that's analogous to walking. So you keep walking, you keep progressing. But when you walk, you put one foot forward, but your other foot is still where you were. So you haven't completely detached, right? It's good, it's incremental growth, it's fine. But it's not a paradigm shift, it's not a complete shift, right? Pesach is the idea of not walking, the idea of jumping. What's the idea of jumping? When you jump, both your feet leave the ground, right? When you jump to something, you jump with both your feet. That's how people jump or skip, right? So both feet are lifted off the ground. It's a complete letting go of where you were and embracing something completely new. And that's why Pesach is the time. Every day we have this idea of Yitziat Mitzrayim, we're going out of Egypt, but Pesach is specifically that time where we talk about this idea of it's time for a shift, it's time to go out of our own personal Egypt. And the important thing before we get to the three components that I want to talk about, the important thing is this, that B'chol dor v'ador, what does b'chol dor v'ador mean? Every generation. And in fact, it's every year, or every day, right? Because Mitzrayim, the idea of Egypt, is a relative concept. Everyone's Mitzrayim is relative. It's their Mitzrayim, right? In other words, and not only every different person, but every person themselves, the Mitzrayim shifts, right? Going out of Mitzrayim means leaving our prison, going out of our comfort zone, right? But then when we go out of our comfort zone and we take a step forward and start to connect to something meaningful and purposeful, after a while we get used to that. And that becomes our norm. And after a while it becomes our Mitzrayim, because now we're resisting going beyond that. Because growth is continuous, right? And that's why every year we have a new Mitzrayim and we have a new exodus from Mitzrayim. And for each person that's different. And that's the important part. Each person is an individual and each person has to go out of their Mitzrayim, right? Using the same tools, but Not everyone can go to the same place at once. Not everyone can do everything at once. Not everyone can embrace everything at once. But we have to, our existence on this earth is to continuously grow. And there's no better yontif that represents the idea of growth than Pesach. And where do we tap into the holiness or the energy of growth? The Seder. Seder is a very holy experience. It's supposed to be, every part of it has meaning and purpose, and there's so much to talk about the Seder. In fact, I'll tell you an interesting fun fact. The Haggadah, right, the Haggadah of Pesach, has many, many books. There's many commentaries on it. It's apparently the most commentated on early work. In other words, it's got, if you look, I have a library, I have like a bit of a hobby. I collect different Haggadot every year, and we haven't bought my new one this year, but I will, probably. But I've got, I must have, I don't know, 50, 60 books on the Haggadah, right? Each with different commentaries, different perspectives, different ideas. After a while, some of them double up a bit, but amazing, right? And there's so many. It's apparently the book, an early Jewish work, like the Talmud has commentaries, everything. But this is an early Jewish work that has the most commentaries on it, right? Because it really is the basis of who we are. The Seder, the experience of Pesach. Interesting statistic, the Seder is apparently the most observed Jewish ritual that there is. Right? Interesting enough. Even people don't know how to do it or don't do it right, whatever, it doesn't matter. But they everyone connects somehow to the Seder. Much more than Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, apparently. Bless you. Right? So it's worth exploring and worth preparing. It's really an amazing experience. By the way, just a commercial in the middle. I mentioned this last week, you might have seen it on the WhatsApps. I started yesterday a WhatsApp group. I'm gonna post 10 videos, each one an insight on the Seder. So if you're interested, you can check with the office. I'll give you the link and you can join that, and yeah, for the next 10 days. I started yesterday, and we can each day I'm gonna post a video on something to do with the Seder. Okay. But what I want to do this week and next week is talk about one passage in the Haggadah. And the Haggadah says, it's towards the end, it's the Haggadah has many passages. It's one of the mitzvot of Pesach night to tell the story and so on. But towards the end, there's a paragraph which says Rabbi Gamliel, one of the Talmudic sages, said that if you really want to fulfill your commitment for the night, you need to discuss three things. Anyone knows that? No? Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. That's what it says. You've got to talk about three concepts. Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Now, Pesach, when he says Pesach, what he's referring to is something we don't do today because we don't have a temple. It's the Paschal Lamb, right? So, just to give you a bit of historic history, right? The historic context. When the Jews left Egypt, they had the very, very first Seder in history, even before they'd left. So, one of the commandments of God was to Moses to instruct the Jewish people that on Pesach night, they left on the 15th of Nisan, right? Which is next Saturday night, right? Not this coming Shabbat, the next. No, what am I talking about? 2 weeks. 2 weeks from the Saturday night, right?
Okay.
No, 2 weeks. It's 3 weeks. It's two weeks and a bit. It's Thursday now. From this Saturday night, 3 weeks. 2 weeks. Yeah. It's creeping up quickly. It's a very unique year, by the way. It's not often that Shabbat is Erev Pesach. Right? Yeah, it's a bit complicated, but it's okay. It's doable. And just a fun fact, in the Jewish calendar, it's not going to happen for another 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. Not that. Yeah. Don't say that. You never know. That's the night of the 15th of the month of Nisan, but the Jews left the next morning, right? But nevertheless, God instructed that the night before, they should take a lamb, the afternoon before, they should take a lamb, they should bring it as a sacrifice. That was when they took some of the blood from that lamb and put it on the doorposts, and that will be a sign of the Jewish home. And that night they should gather, in preparation for God bringing the final plague of the firstborn, they should gather, and when they gather, they should eat some of that roasted lamb, and matzah and maror, Right? So they had a sort of a seder already the night before they left. Those are the three mitzvot. Today we don't have the... And then from then on, every time they had when they had a temple or in the desert, when they had a mishkan, every year on the 14th, they would bring this lamb and they would eat it at the seder, roasted lamb, they would bring at the seder on the night of the seder, right? They would eat it at the same time we eat the afikoman. We eat afikoman to remember the eating of the korban Pesach. Okay. So, and then we have the mitzvah of eating matzah and the mitzvah of eating the bitter herbs. Today, of course, the most important mitzvah of the Seder is to have a big piece of shmura matzah. That's a big mitzvah. If anyone is not unable to get shmura matzah, please let me know. It's very important to keep that. That's the way we connect to the Seder, to eat the big piece of matzah. But Rabban Gamliel says that really to fulfill the obligation of experiencing the Seder, you need to talk about these three ideas. The sacrifice of Korban Pesach, which although we don't have today, we still learn about it and still spiritually connect to it. Then we need to talk about matzah and we need to talk about maror, the bitter herb. So for some reason, these three ideas become like the foundation of the Seder experience and the formula for personal freedom. So for the remaining time today, I want to talk about Pesach. That's the first one. And the next week, we'll talk about the matzah and the maror and what the significance is and what it means to us and what... how we apply that, right? So, the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, right? This was brought, as I said, in Egypt, and also it was then brought every year in Pesach, as long as the Jews had a temple. So, Pesach has a number of components. Let's talk about a number of lessons we learned from the Pesach. First is, the fact that they took a lamb in Egypt was highly significant. Why a lamb specifically? So we know that Egypt was an immoral country and also was a country that was riddled with pagan worship, right? At the time the Jews were there. Part of the pagan worship experience that they had in Egypt was, I know it sounds weird, but they served lambs. This was their thing, sheep, lambs. That was their thing. So the lamb was a deity of the Egyptian culture. But it's not so ancient. You have that today in India, a cat with cows, I think. I think the cows today are the Avodah Zarah, the idol worship of India, or the Hindus, or some part of India, whatever. But this was the thing of Egypt, right? So God says 4 days before they leave Egypt, the Jews each family needs to take a lamb, keep it in their house, and prepare for shechting it on Erev Pesach, on Erev Pesach, spilling the blood on the doorpost, and eating it roasted on Pesach night. So when the Jews did this, this was a huge leap of faith. Because obviously all the Egyptians wanted to know, what are you doing with the lambs, right? And they told them. They told them, "We in 4 days' time, God is going to bring about the final plague. Then the Egyptian Pharaoh is going to let us go and we are going to leave." So the Midrash tells us that what actually happened, it was a Shabbat. The Jews left on Thursday. This all happened on the Shabbat before. And which is one of the reasons Shabbat before Pesach is called Shabbat HaGadol, the big Shabbat, because the story started then. What happened was the firstborns, by then the Jews had a pretty good track record because they had finished with 9 of the plagues, right? And every time Moses told them that God is about to bring a plague, it happened. By then, by that time, when the Jews said something's going to happen, they believed them. So the firstborns ran to Pharaoh and said, "You better let them out now, like before 4 days from now, right?" And Pharaoh refused. And the Midrash says that actually a mini civil war broke out. And a lot of Egyptians fell already on that day, even before the Jews left Egypt. And that's why that was the beginning of the Exodus, so to speak. But the concept of taking a Korban Pesach had two ideas. It was the concept of, before you can go out of Egypt, you have to let Egypt go. You have to let go, right? What does this mean? And this is often the issue with growth. When Moses was the famous story of Moses was at the burning bush. So many years before that, a few years before that, Moses was out of Egypt. He was running away from Egypt. He was in his father-in-law's town, Yitro, and he had the famous vision of the burning bush, where he saw this bush that was burning, and yet it wasn't being consumed. And was miraculous, and he said he saw that it's a very special thing. So the Torah tells us that Moses looks up and he sees this burning bush, right? And he says, Asura na ve'ere. Let me turn away and let me go and see what's happening at this bush. Very strange expression. Doesn't say, it's not like he looks up and sees this thing in the distance and says, let me go have a look. He uses the word asura na. Let me turn away and I'm going to go look, right? So it's a funny expression. So Rashi, the great commentator Rashi, says four words. He said, what did Moses mean when he said, Asura, I'm going to turn away? Rashi says, what Moses meant was, I'll say it in Hebrew and I'll translate, Asura mikan lehitkarev lesham. Let me go away from here to come close there. Right? What does that mean? Whenever we grow, part of the, you know, there's a Yiddish expression, I don't know if you're not aware of it, but there's a Yiddish expression, Amikanish tansen laf Allah chasenes. You can't dance at two weddings at the same time. You've got a conflict between two weddings, you've got to make a choice, either this wedding or that wedding, right? It's meant, the expression, Yiddish has some lovely expressions, but the expression is meant to teach us the following. There are certain things, certain values that we take on, certain things of growth that we experience. And yet sometimes we want to experience them, but we want to stay where we are. It's like having your cake and eat it kind of thing, right? That's sort of that expression. And the first step to real growth or to real paradigm shift in any area of life, particularly in self-improvement or spiritual improvement and so on, is that you have to be able to let go. Growth comes with a sacrifice. Growth comes with giving up stuff, turning away from things, rejecting certain values that are in conflict with the values that I want to embrace, leaving certain practices that are in conflict with those that I want to embrace. So therefore, when we grow, when we go out of our own Egypt, when we have a paradigm shift, there's two components. One is, we've got to make a break. We've got to let the past go, right? You can't work on your anger if you still want to be angry with someone for the next 5 years, right? You've got to let go. You've got to let go of the anger and then embrace a better way of living. But there's a lot of letting go that needs to take place. And by the way, in the process, in the journey of growth, letting go is probably the hardest thing to do. Right? The hardest thing to do, because we always remain stuck with the things we want to hang on to. It almost feels good. Like feels comfortable, right? Even the Jews, a lot of them didn't want to leave Egypt. Can you imagine that? Like sometimes, right? And there's a very good lesson in that. Always they resisted. In fact, 4/5 of the Jewish nation didn't leave because they didn't want to go. Right? Yeah, that's an interesting fact, right?
Did they actually stay or did they all have to go?
No, they actually 4/5 remained in Egypt and died during the plague of darkness.
Ah.
Yeah, because they didn't want to go out. It's another discussion about that, but right? Although we are taught that once, this was all pre-Mount Sinai, pre-giving of the Torah. It says when Mashiach will come, there's a famous expression, no Jew will be left behind, right? We're all going out of this exile. But then it was different. Because they didn't want to go. Why didn't want to go? Because that's what they knew. What is it what they knew? They were slaves, they were oppressed, but they didn't want to go out. Because the unknown is very hard. But you know, it sounds bizarre, but the truth is we do it ourselves as well, in a spiritual way, an emotional way. Often people will tell you how bad things are and they want to change, but they can't because they can't let go of what they know. Because what they know is safe, even though it's bad and it's a bad habit, it doesn't even feel good. But kind of there's a comfort in remaining where you are, right? One of the great praises for the Jewish people that did go out of Egypt and followed Moses into the wilderness, it was said by Jeremiah the prophet. And he says a prophecy from God. He says, Komar Hashem, he says, he praises the Jewish people. It's one of the great things that are in the favor that we, you know, the favor of the Jewish nation. That God recognized that when we left Egypt, we had the faith to yes, let go, to move out. Lech teich acharai b'midbar, you followed me into the wilderness. You went to a place that nothing was growing. You went to an unknown. You believed, emunah, you had faith. And because of that faith, they were ready to let go of Egypt and move. The symbol of leaving Egypt, and this is why it was considered so important, and this is why Rabban Gamliel says that it's an important thing to discuss at the Seder, the importance of it, was expressed in bringing the Paschal lamb. In other words, slaughtering the idol of Egypt. That was the idea. It was disassociating. We have not, because the Jews in Egypt had assimilated. The Jews in Egypt had also been part of the idol worship. Right? Yeah, we kept our identity as another race, but we didn't actually serve God in Egypt. It was quite a, it's quite a thing, right? In fact, we served idols. That's what we did. We actually were part of the idol worship of Egypt. And yet, God wanted to keep the promise that he gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and we were destined to leave and become God's nation and so on. But he said, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to slaughter this Avodah Zarah. You've got to actually get rid of it. You've got to let go of this pagan worship if you want to come closer to Mount Sinai and become God's nation. If you want to go out of Egypt, you're going to have to actively leave Egypt behind you. You can't take Egypt with you when you leave. And that's the foundation of growth. You can't take your previous habits and your previous emotional struggles and your previous perceptions and values and whatever it is. You can't take them all with you and say you want to grow at the same time, because you're just taking the problem with you. You know, there's a, right? Sometimes people, it's like, you know, we see this sometimes. Sometimes people have issues that they're dealing with, and they decide to move location. They move to another city, or they move to another country, right? I once read a letter to Baba Chereva. A parent was saying the child having issues. It's hard for him to learn in yeshiva, whatever, and the whole thing, all kinds of things, and maybe you should just send him overseas. So the Rebbe very simplistically but profoundly answered. He said, everyone has a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. Everyone has a good inclination and a bad inclination, right? The things that push us to the good, the things that push us to bad. He says, what do you think when your child goes to another country to learn, the Yetzer Hara is not coming with? Right? Everything's coming with him. They call it in English geographical therapy. And most times it doesn't work, right? There are cases where it's important. Sometimes you make a break from the community, from the environment. But most times it doesn't work. You just take your problems with you, right? Why? Because to grow, you need to leave. And that's the Korban Pesach. You need to say goodbye. But that's not enough. Because the Rambam tells us that the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, the mitzvah of bringing the Paschal Lamb, had two components to it. In fact, in the 613 mitzvot, it's considered two separate mitzvot. One was to offer up the animal, to shech the korban, in other words, to slaughter the lamb, right? And the next one was to eat the meat on the Pesach night. They're both obligatory. It wasn't like you shech the korban Pesach in the daytime and that's it, right? But a very, very important part of this mitzvah, so important that it gets its own prominence, was to eat the korban Pesach. The Mishnah tells us in the Talmud that the Korban Pesach, its goal was not just to slaughter the animal, the goal was to eat the meat. Right? Today, we don't have a Korban, but we spiritually re-experience this idea where we eat the Afikoman towards the end of the Seder, right? That is, instead of eating the Korban Pesach. But the same idea. What's the idea of eating? Why is it so important to eat the Korban? Apart from the fact that every Jewish experience seems to be important to eat, but there's a specific thing about eating the Korban Pesach. The idea is because sometimes you can make a break, sometimes you can let go, sometimes you can be inspired to grow and you can sort of make a move, but you haven't internalized it. It hasn't become part of your experience, right? You have to ingest it, otherwise it's not you. It has to become you. It has to become your new identity, right? We discussed this when we did Atomic Habits, I don't know if you remember. Right, that, you know, he makes this point. He says when someone starts to lessen their smoking or not smoke, you know, you can't say I'm a smoker who's given up smoking. You have to say I'm a non-smoker. You have to become someone who doesn't smoke. Right. Same thing. When we want to grow, it's not enough just to make a break. We've got to change who we are, and to change who we are means that new inspiration must become something that's who we are. We have to internalize it. And that's why the eating of the Korban Pesach was so important. You let go of the idol worship. You've assumed something different. You're now becoming closer to God, coming closer to good values, to proper morality, and so on and so forth. That has to become who you are, otherwise not sustainable, right? And that's why the Korban Pesach has to be offered, but then it has to be the meat, the new meat, in other words, you've slaughtered the idol, but now the meat that you have left is something new, and you actually have to eat it, because otherwise that's a symbol of internalization. Where do we have the concept of internalization, spiritually speaking, in Jewish practice? This is the concept the famous author of the Tanya explains this at length. And he says that's the idea of Jewish knowledge. Right? In Jewish experience, we have two components. We have Torah and mitzvot. We have learning, understanding, and then we have observance. This concept of internalization can only really happen I mean, not to undermine the observance of a mitzvah, of course, that's so important, eating matzah Pesach, putting up mezuzahs on the door, those are critical things, but it has to come together with learning, otherwise we don't internalize it. Learning, understanding, study of Torah in the Talmud, in the Tanakh, is referred to as mazon, the food for the soul. Because when you understand something, you internalize it. When you do something, you and the thing are still remain different. Right? You do a mitzvah, you give charity, you put up mezuzah, critically important, but you and the mezuzah haven't become one. Right? Even if you do a kindness to someone else, you and the kindness haven't become one. It's only when you learn about it and understand it and the concepts become who you are, that's how you internalize it. Going back to this concept, we talk about the narrowness of the throat, right? How do we overcome that? What's the idea? So one of the ideas is we have, you know, in the journey of intellect, we have the three components, Chochmah, Bina, and Da'at. We've talked about this many times, right? Chochmah, Bina, Da'at. Chochmah is when you conceive a new idea. Bina is when you understand the idea. So what's Da'at? Right? Because very often this is the problem. The reason why the idea doesn't make it to the heart and gets stuck in the throat is because we're missing the third component. The third component is Da'at. Da'at can literally, loosely be translated as knowledge. But actually Da'at has more than that. Da'at in Biblical Hebrew actually means to connect. In fact, early on in the Chumash in the Torah, the word Da'at was used for to describe intimacy. When the Torah tells us that Adam and Eve were created, right? And it says they lived together and they had children. It says, Va'adam yada et ishto. Adam knew his wife, meaning he was intimate with his wife. And we have that for many generations, right? Not why, because Da'at means to connect. When we learn an idea, we must make sure that we understand it properly. But more than that, we have to connect to it. We have to learn it again, reflect upon it, connect to it, understand its application, really learn it and understand it well, ingest it well. That's the true idea of eating, of understanding, internalizing. And then it starts to filter through into the heart as well and make a difference in how we feel. So that's the Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach means, number one, we've got to let go of previous stuff. We've got to let go, become something different, right? Paradigm shift means to let go. We've got to experience the idea of letting go. Bad habit, bad perspectives, bad thinking, toxic emotions, spiritual problems, whatever they might be. If you want to grow, there's a letting go process that has to take place. And that's the slaughtering of the Korban Pesach. But then, it can't just be a momentary phase. It's got to be something that we hang on to and something that we learn about and internalize. And that's the second part of the Korban Pesach, the idea of eating it, right? Okay, I want to go through two more things about the Korban Pesach, which is also, again, very, very important to the process of our personal freedom and our personal redemption journey. So I'll just give you a quick crash course here on some of the laws of sacrifices. So in the temple, there were many sacrifices that were brought, right? Sacrifices is a complicated topic, it's not for now, but that's the fact. There was part of the Torah is offering sacrifices. But there were two types of sacrifices. There was something called the Korban Tzibur, a communal sacrifice, right? And then there was something called Korban Yachid, a individual sacrifice. So Korban Tzibur, for example, every day in the temple, they would bring a morning sacrifice, which now we pray instead, like the morning prayer, right? But that was brought by the administration of the temple, and that was representing the Jewish people. So it was a communal sacrifice. On Shabbat, there was an extra one called Musaf, which was a communal one, and so on. Right? That was communal sacrifices. Then there were people who would donate. Once in a while, a person would either be obligated to bring a personal korban, like they would a sin offering to atone for something or a donation just to become closer to God. So they wanted to engage in the bringing a personal sacrifice. So that was a sacrifice brought by the individual. Each one of them has halachic features. Okay. So a korban tzibur, for example, a communal sacrifice, has set times. So either it's daily, or it's on Shabbat, or it's on the Chagim. Communal sacrifices have set times. Individual sacrifices don't have a set time. It's when it happens. Either when you're obligated to do it, or like a woman after giving birth will bring a sacrifice. In many, many instances where a person will bring a personal sacrifice, but it only took place when it took place. It wasn't you couldn't predict when it was going to happen. It happens only on a certain time. The other feature that's very different is communal sacrifices are funded by the community, right? It's a communal sacrifice. So it's paid for by communal funds. Whereas a korban yachid, an individual sacrifice, obviously had to be funded by the individual, and it was an individual thing to do, right? When it comes to the Korban Pesach, which is really the first sacrifice that the Jews brought in Egypt even, we find a very, very, it's like a hybrid. It's not really an individual sacrifice, it's not really a communal sacrifice. Why? Because everyone was obligated to bring it on the same day, it's predictable, which is a feature of a communal sacrifice, right? And yet, every family bought individually and funded it individually. So it had features of individual sacrifice and features of a communal sacrifice, right? Why is that so significant after I've given you that legalistic approach to the sacrifices? This is very, very fundamental. Because when we know Pesach is when we became a nation, right? This is a really important thing. One of the prophets, Yechezkel, Ezekiel, describes the exodus from Egypt as the birthday of the Jewish people, which was a process. We were born when we came out of Egypt, and we fully became God's nation on Shavuot at Mount Sinai 7 weeks later. But what does it mean we were born? I mean, we were around since Abraham, right? We were 12 tribes in Egypt. We were a whole nation in Egypt. So what does a nation mean, right? A nation means something very important. A nation means not that it's a bunch of individuals that happen to belong to one family or one ancestry or one ethnic group. That's not a nation. In Judaism, a nation means that they fundamentally become and intrinsically become one unit, right? So this idea that all the Jewish people became a nation, which means they became intrinsically bound with each other, connected to each other, so much so they became like one unit, that idea of oneness, that happened with going out of Egypt, right? So we became one. That's that oneness became when we left Egypt. However, the Torah teaches us the following. As you become a nation, God says to us, right? Which means you become my people, you become a unit, a oneness. It is at the same time very important not to forget the role of the individual. And that's what Judaism emphasizes in many, many different ways. Every person is an individual. Every person is different. And yet we're all part of one. Together, right? This was played out, again, 7 weeks later when God gave us the Torah on Mount Sinai. Where he gave us the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments has a very interesting thing to it. It was said to the entire Jewish nation that were present, not only the Jewish nation, but we are told that even the future souls stood at Har Sinai, right? And what did God say? He spoke to us, but he spoke to us in the first person singular. He said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am God, your God. But in Hebrew, you know, we conjugate words into singular and plural, right? In English, you means the same thing. I'm talking to one person, I'm talking to 100 people, I can still say you, right? But in Hebrew, it doesn't work like that. If God was talking to so many millions of people, it should have said, Ani Hashem Elokechem, I'm God, your God, collectively, right? But he didn't. He said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, as if he was talking to one person. And he was, because he was talking to each individual separately. God was saying, every individual matters. Every individual's different contribution matters. But so does the oneness of a nation matter. You have to have the same thing. In other words, God wouldn't have given the Torah to individual. It had to be given to the entire nation, and all had to be present, and had to be united and one. And yet, he said every individual must shine. And that's why the foundation of going out of Egypt was the Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach wasn't a communal sacrifice, it wasn't an individual sacrifice, it was both. Why? Because both have to come together. I've often mentioned this idea, but I'll tell you where this reflects in such a beautiful way. The laws of writing a mezuzah or tefillin or a Torah scroll, right? So we know that every letter has to be written beautifully and there's all kinds of laws, right? Now, for a Torah scroll to be kosher, for example, there's over 300,000 letters in a Torah scroll and they all have to be there. Why? Because a kosher Torah scroll means it's a oneness made up of many, many different letters and every letter has to be there. So really it's a community, it's a connectedness, it's a oneness. It's like a nation. We are all like a letter in a Sefer Torah. We're all part of the whole. Right? A letter on its own is invalid. It needs to be with all the other letters together. It's like a nation of letters. Yet, there's a very, very beautiful law when it comes to writing a Torah or Tefillin or Mezuzah. Although all the letters have to be there because they all become part of a oneness, but every letter must be written alone. It cannot be connected at all to the other letter. Even if a little thin line of ink connects one letter to the other, the entire Torah is invalid. It can be fixed, but it's invalid the way it is. Can't use it. It's called a negi'ah if it's touching another letter. Why? Because every letter is part of a whole and not an individual, and yet the individuality cannot be dissolved. By the way, this is a great lesson in relationships in general. That's what relationships are all about. Relationships are a oneness, a connectedness, and yet it's only an efficient and effective and deep connectedness if the individuality of each person doesn't get dissolved. That's for another discussion, but it's a really, really important... It's a very important relationship lesson, right? The individuality of each person has to be valued because everyone's different. And as a Jew, part of God's nation, we're exactly the same. We're all part of one destiny, we're all part of one values system, we're all part of one Torah, we're all part of one journey. We're all connected, deeply connected to each other. And we also subscribe to common values. There are certain things we're all supposed to do. We're all supposed to act kindly. We're all supposed to have a mezuzah on our door. We're all supposed to have a seder on Pesach. We're all supposed to we do a lot of similar things. And yet God says, you're all individuals as well. Everyone does it a little bit differently. Everyone has a different area of emphasis. Everyone has a different contribution. And every contribution is critical and important. And that's, as we sit down to the Seder and we talk about our growth and our birth as a nation and who we are and what's our foundation, this is again a lesson from Pesach, the Korban Pesach, that we're individual and we're not an individual. We're part of one, which is so important, and yet we also our individuality doesn't get dissolved. Each letter has to stand alone. For this reason, I'll just end with a very fascinating Maharal. The Maharal of Prague, which I've mentioned many times, a great philosopher in the 16th century, one of my ancestors, as I've shared with you before. That's where the name Gurari comes from, because he wrote a commentary on Rashi called Gur Aryeh. He wrote many books. So I try to learn some of his stuff once in a while. That's why I was very special when I took my trip in December. I was in Prague to be at his gravesite for the first time. It was a very special experience. But he has a whole book just on Pesach and the Haggadah, one of the many commentaries on the Haggadah. Very deep, very philosophical. It takes time to learn. It's not a quick thought. He's a very deep philosopher. And he has a whole section on the Korban Pesach. And he says that the Korban Pesach was really fundamental in creating this oneness of the Jewish nation. And he says it reflects in the laws of Korban Pesach. How so? He said, I'll finish with a story, a beautiful story. He says, because there's a midrash that says that a very big animal like a cow, for example, if a cow injures his hand or his arm, whatever, leg, whatever, not necessarily the pain isn't necessarily felt in the whole cow, right? So he's a big animal, he's healthy. So he feels the pain in our leg. Some of you also, we feel pain in our leg. Doesn't mean we feel pain everywhere. We just feel pain where it's hurting. But a lamb apparently is different. A lamb is a very sensitive, refined, edel, as they call it in Yiddish, animal, right? It's a very fragile animal. If a lamb gets hurt anywhere in the body, it feels it in the whole body. And he says, that's why God told us to bring a Korban Pesach when we left Egypt, because Egypt was the birth of our nation. Yes, we remain individuals, but we become one. And becoming one intrinsically means that we are bound. And if one person is hurting, we're all hurting. As we've seen this displayed really, really well in the last 2 years, unfortunately. But it's an amazing thing, right? I'll just end with a quick story. There was a famous, I've forgotten when exactly it happened, there was a famous... The last blood libel that happened was the Bayless trial, a very famous Bayless trial. And it was in Russia and Ukraine, actually. And there was a very big court case, and actually the Jew won, but it was very, very big. The whole world got involved. All the rabbis of the whole world got involved. It was like an amazing thing. And one of the prosecutors said he's going to show you how bad the Jews are, right? Yeah. That in the Talmud, there's a passage that says, it's a passage which is relevant to some halachot, where you can do something through a messenger. And anyway, it calls the Jewish people Adam. And Adam means like, we're called Adam, human. And you could read the Talmud, if you're looking for problems, you could read it that like, only the Jewish people are called Adam. Everyone else is not called an Adam, right? And that sounds terrible, right? So he brought this up in court very cleverly. And they wrote to a very great sage called Rameir Shapiro to ask him what they should answer. Obviously, that's... The Torah has respect for all human life. And so why does it, you know, what does it mean? What does the Talmud mean when it says that? And he answered the most beautiful thing. He says, there are many words to describe human being in Hebrew, right? Ish, Enosh, all different types of terms. And then Adam. Adam is also in it. The amazing thing about the word Adam is that there's no plural form for Adam. So for example, Ish is singular. Ish means a man. In plural, it's Anashim. Right? Isha is a woman. In Hebrew, it's Nashim. Right? So there's plural. For every description of human being, there's plural. Except for one, Adam. There's no plural for that. He says, why? Because that's specifically to the Jewish nation. He says, tell the judge like this. He said, when did you have last time where someone in Ukraine, a non-Jew, stood trial and the entire world got involved? You never had that. Right? And suddenly this bailiff is standing trial and the whole Jewish nation is involved. Why? Because when one Jew's on trial, everyone's on trial. So that's the Jewish nation. Adam. Because that's what the Talmud means. It doesn't mean any human life is not important. Every individual is created in the image of God. Every person is amazing. And so on and so forth. But this quality of being an intrinsically one nation, that's the concept of Adam. That's why says the Maharal, says many things about this, but just one idea. That's why it says that the Korban Pesach had to be a lamb. Because God was creating this oneness in the Jewish people. And yet at the same time, it's an individual sacrifice because we have to understand the worth. Because one of the risks of becoming oneness is that we start relying on everyone else. We say, well, I don't matter then. I'll just leave it to someone else. He'll do it for me. No. You're still an individual and your contribution is still really important. So that's one of the three things of Pesach is the Pesach of the Seder is the Pesach. Letting go, internalizing and understanding this idea of oneness and individuality working together. Next week, please God, we'll talk about the other two, Matzah and Maror. Have a wonderful day.